Our reading this evening is from the book of Exodus. It won't surprise you to know after what I said earlier. And I'm going to read from Exodus chapters 1 and 2. Not the whole of chapters 1 and 2. I'm going to start reading at verse 8 of chapter 1 and go through to verse 10 of chapter 2. So it's quite a chunk, but it seemed good to keep it together. So Exodus chapter 1, beginning at verse 8. Then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And they built Pithom and Ramesses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with harsh labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their harsh labor, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, when you are helping the Hebrew women during childbirth on the delivery stool, if you see that the baby is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, let her live. The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. And then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live? And the midwives answered Pharaoh, Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive. So God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. And then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people. Every Hebrew boy that is born you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. Now a man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. And when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. And she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her female slave to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying and she felt sorry for him. This is one of the Hebrew babies, she said. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and get you one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you? Yes, go, she answered. So the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you. So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, "I drew him out of the water." Thanks be to God. So I've called this series, however it goes on, however long it goes on, Walking in a Strange Land. It's a strange land because it's a long way from us in time, in place, in culture. But of course, it's what all these characters we read about were doing and being invited to do by God. They were being invited to put their trust in Him as they walked in a strange land, a land that was unknown to them. And I've called this first one Basket Case. There's a certain ambiguity about that. Firstly, of course, it has to do with the basket in which Moses was placed. I remember that was one of my favourite stories. You know how sometimes memories come back to you, and I don't know where it came from, but from about 60 years ago, you know, came back this memory of my mum just sitting with me in a morning. Every morning we'd look at a Bible story in a book of Bible stories, but I remember this one about Moses being put in a basket and put out on the water as being one which, I don't know, somehow registered. And of course, Basket Case, in a sense, I would reserve for Pharaoh, but as a description, because I think he was a bit. So we're looking at this passage from verse 8 of chapter 1 through to verse 10 of chapter 2. Now, in fact, what the first seven verses of Exodus does is to remind us of the posterity of the children of Israel who were in Egypt. It just very briefly reminds us how Joseph ended up in Egypt, how he ended up not only in Egypt, but as one of the senior rulers in Egypt. We're reminded how, when he went to bury his father, Jacob, he was accompanied by the dignitaries of the court and all the dignitaries of Egypt. You know, all his fellow civil servants, all his fellow government ministers, they had such regard for him, such respect for his position, that they went to the burial of Jacob too. It tells us a very great deal about the estimate that was given to Joseph and to his brothers, for they were honored too. And they did well in Egypt. They prospered. They became a prosperous group of people. But when things began to go a bit sour in the economy and the politics of the land, they became the scapegoats for all the problems. And you see this happening again and again down through history. Who were the people who actually, until most of the money was wasted on the First World War, really managed to resurrect the economy of Germany and its states? But it was the Jewish people who had come to live among them and were honored for their banking skills and prowess and so on. But as things went sour, they were held to be the people who had caused the misery. They prospered, it was seen, while Germans lived in poverty. And the world turned around against them 180 degrees. And we know how the result was the terrible Holocaust of the Second World War years. That indefensible slaughter of innocent people, 6 million of them. And sadly, we see that going on and on in different situations in the world, a different magnitude, but still we see that spirit coming out from time to time. We're a people with a posterity who have grown prosperous, become a major inconvenience. And in a sense, the whole thing is underlined when we get our first mention of the Pharaoh. The writer says, then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt. They were ominous words. Israel's time in Egypt was about to move from one of prosperity to persecution. What had once seemed like a promising place to grow into a godly nation, what some of them must have thought was the promised land, became a house of bondage. It became a wasteland. They came to know heartbreaking torment. It was painful for them. The new dynasty had come to power, and it was with the new regime, out with the old regime. And when it comes to power politics, it's all about who you know. And unfortunately, the new Pharaoh did not know his history. He did not know about Joseph. He did not know how Joseph had saved the Egyptians from utter ruin. And so he felt no sense of obligation to Joseph's descendants, who had now become the problem. And gradually the Egyptians began to fear the Israelites, and then to hate them, until finally they wanted to subjugate them. And this part of Exodus, says one writer, is about Satan's opposition to God's plans and promises for his people. From it we learn how to remain faithful to God, even in times of tribulation. So we're faced here with the reality of power and politics and being on the wrong end of them. The new Pharaoh thought he had a problem. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, they will join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. And like most dictators, the new Pharaoh was insecure, not to say paranoid. Oh, he had military superiority, but he was still worried about getting overthrown. And the more foreigners that were in his country, the more alarmed he became. And soon the immigrant population grew so large that it threatened to destabilize his entire government. And he worried that the next time he was attacked, the Israelites would join forces with his enemies, outnumber his own army, and bring his dynasty to the end. Actually, what seems to have been the case was that the Israelites were pretty comfy, thank you. They were not unhappy with their lot. They were not looking to go anywhere else. This was good for them. This was a nice place to be. here we find one of those occasions, as already mentioned, in human history, where an excuse is made, and it's been said that an excuse is a thin skin of reason wrapped around a lie. Pharaoh used the threat of warfare as a pretext for persecuting foreigners. Blaming things on ethnic minorities is always convenient because racism is part of our sinful human nature. Prejudice is part of our sinful human nature. That's what made it so easy for Hitler to promote anti-Semitism in Nazi Germany. It's why the Afrikaners were able to use the black threat argument to such deadly advantage in South Africa. And it's why each new wave of immigrants, from the Irish to the Pakistanis and the Poles, has faced prejudice upon coming to this country. And any group, sizable group, moving to any country has undergone that experience. And playing the race card can work politically. It worked for Pharaoh. His advisors were only too willing to agree that something had to be done about those Israelites. And so we're told they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramesses as store cities for Pharaoh. It was an ultimate political solution. The new policy simultaneously solved both Egypt's immigrant problem and its labor problem. With their spirits crushed and backs bent with pain, the Israelites would be unable to rebel. And as an added benefit, Pharaoh's tyranny would lead to the construction of two great cities, Pithom and Ramesses. But the lust for power is never properly satisfied. And in time, the Israelites became more bitterly enslaved. They were treated more and more harshly until finally the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with hard labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly. Bit of a wonder, really, that Pharaoh didn't just build a wall round Egypt to keep them all out. But they were persecuted, these people. One of the interesting literary features of Exodus is that significant words or themes often come in groups of seven. And one example is in verses 13 and 14 here, which use seven words, some of which are repeated, for Israel's slavery. One scholar has translated it like this, and he says, each word is like another blow from a slave driver's whip. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel work, one, with rigor, two, and made their lives bitter and with hard service, three, in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work, four, in the field, in addition to all their other work, five, wherein they made them serve, six, with rigor, seven. With each crack of the whip, Pharaoh was striking another blow against the God of Israel. Because ultimately, this was a spiritual conflict. Pharaoh was really fighting against God, and he wanted to turn God's people against God. The idea being, press them hard enough, persecute them hard enough, they will turn round, shake their fists against God, and never want to know him again. Pharaoh resented God's people. And he rejected God's promises. God had covenanted to make his people into a great nation. The more numerous they became, the more his promise was fulfilled. If Pharaoh had been God's servant, he would have rejoiced at the birth of each new Hebrew baby, but he didn't. Instead, the fulfillment of God's promise filled him and his nation with fear and loathing. So he also resisted God's plan, which was to give his people a land to call their own, the homeland he had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It was the same land that Joseph had prophesied for his brothers. By faith, we're told, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions about his bones. A land flowing with milk and honey was the next phase in God's eternal plan for his people. Pharaoh says, we must deal shrewdly with them or they will leave the country. Which seems very odd, because on the other hand you would think that was exactly what he wanted. He wanted rid of the Israelites, but on the other hand, the Israelites were a wonderful source of free slave labor. And so Pharaoh actually set himself up as the obstacle to God's will, because the more he objected to the Exodus, the more he was standing in the way of what God wanted to do with and for his people. Pharaoh is a sort of classic portrayal of a man in rebellion against God. He resents God's people, rejects God's promises, resists God's plans. And it's fascinating, isn't it? The big question the archaeologists and the historians have about Pharaoh is, which Pharaoh was this? Because he is never named in the annals of Scripture. It's interesting, because later on, when we have the record of the exile, we know all about King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, we know about King Darius, we know about Cyrus of Persia, who allowed the Israelites to go back from Babylon to Jerusalem. We know the names of the naughty men, but we don't know the name of the greatest of them, the Pharaoh. He's just called the King of Egypt, or simply Pharaoh. And in a sense, there's a spiritual significance in that. One writer, James Hoffmeyer, says, the absence of the Pharaoh's name may ultimately be for theological reasons, because the Bible is not trying to answer the question, who is the Pharaoh of the Exodus, to satisfy the curiosity of modern historians. Rather, it was seeking to clarify for Israel who was the God of the Exodus. The Pharaoh of Egypt was not a private individual. He represented the entire nation of Egypt, including their gods. I mean, the Pharaoh claimed to be the incarnate son of Re, the sun god, who was the primary deity in the Egyptian pantheon. And we can spend, and people have spent lifetimes, researching the Pharaoh. And we can get fascinated in something like, someone like a character like this. And just think of the lovely, juicy interpretations that have been on film and in drama of this character. You know, most of us, we think of Pharaoh, we think of Yul Brynner. And yet, we can become so obsessed with that we miss the whole point. The whole point is not Pharaoh at all. The whole point is God's relationship to God's people. Pharaoh had this strategy for claiming sovereignty over Israel, and it was slavery. And we know from some of the, and of course, in the last 100 years, or just a bit more, there's been a fantastic amount of archaeology done, which has revealed all sorts of interesting things, like this from Edfu, where these are slaves. You can see some of them have their hands bound, and they're all bundled together and being pushed, and off screen there are pictures of the ones with whips sort of driving them forward. And there are pictures in Rechmaya of in Thebes, or the tomb of Rechmaya, of slaves building, here making bricks. This is an extract from that. You'll notice the one in the top left is sitting down and holding a stick. He's not doing anything. Well, that's because he's the Egyptian on the scene. He's got the whip. He doesn't need to be working hard. The people working hard are the slaves. So we know that this is how the Egyptians built their cities, through organized labor camps, slave labor. And it was cruel, and it was hard, and we have records that tell us that that is the case. One writer describes an Egyptian master traveling down the Nile to inspect his slaves. Now the scribe lands on the shore, he surveys the harvest. Attendants are behind him with staffs, Nubians with clubs. One says to a slave, "Give grain." There is none. He is beaten savagely. He is bound, thrown in the well, submerged head down. His wife is bound in his presence. His children are in fetters. The black slaves of the plantations in the 18th and 19th centuries align themselves so much with the slaves of Israel in Egypt. When Israel was in Egypt land, "Let my people go, oppressed so hard they could not stand. Let my people go, go down Moses," as the old song said. Now of course, there's a problem here, because we find God's people suffering. Should God's people be suffering? Well, the first thing to say about that, of course, is that Israel's suffering is the result of the Egyptians' actions. The Egyptians are to blame, led by the Pharaoh. But that doesn't mean that their suffering was outside of God's control. Could God have prevented his people falling into slavery? Of course he could have. But that was not his plan. It was through God's providence that the Israelites went down to Egypt, and it was by his providence that they became slaves there. You see, they'd gone down to Egypt and they'd become comfortable, settled. And many experts looking at it say they weren't very far from becoming thoroughly Egyptianized, thoroughly adopted into the society. God had to do something to create within them the desire to move on to the promised land he had for them. God has many reasons for allowing his people to suffer hardship, but the most obvious is to help us grow. And the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. Exodus 1:12 tells us. In all probability, if they'd been left to themselves, they'd have been melted, they'd have melted and been absorbed into the Egyptian race and lost their identity as God's special people. And one of the ways God maintains the difference of his people from everybody else is through that enslavement in Egypt, which became the dominating bit of history that the Israelites would talk about till the very present, and especially their release at the Exodus. Then we come across the first pro-life campaigners recorded in the scriptures, Shifra and Pua, the two midwives. Whether, given how many Israelites were, these were all the midwives that there were, or whether these were the people in charge of the midwives, we don't know. The speculation, were they Egyptians or were they Israelites themselves? Certainly the names they're given here are Israelite names. And they throw up a big problem which many of the early church fathers wrestled with because they told a big fib. Boys kept on being born to the Israelites after Herod had given the order that any boys, just as they came out of the mother, as they were born, they should be killed. And Shifra and Pua said, well, you know, the problem is, you know, these Israelite women, you know, they're not like Egyptian women. You know, Egyptian women take a long, long while to give birth. You know, it's hard work, but with the Israelite women, it's just like that, and you miss it if you're not paying attention, of course. Well, of course, it was all utter rubbish. And you'll find, if you go to the literature, this long sort of argument about people, whether they should have told the lie or not. And of course, it's one of those things which goes on and on. I've got a quote here from J.B. Lightfoot, a 19th century Anglican bishop. Was he Bishop of Durham? Yes. He said, the words of the Hebrew midwives were not a lie, but a glorious confession of their faith. Their lie, if it can even be considered a lie, was such a whopper that they can hardly be accused of trying to deceive anyone. Think about it. If what Shifra and Pua said was literally true, then why would the Hebrews even need midwives? This is one of the places where understanding a Bible requires a sense of humor. Speaking tongue-in-cheek, the midwives were making sport of Pharaoh by suggesting that the Hebrews were hardier than the Egyptians. What they said was more a joke than a lie. Thus Pharaoh was mocked as well as deceived. But of course, in this story, we also see a story of God's protection of his people. There is no doubt that many young boys of the Israelites were slaughtered. But one was put into a tarred basket, floated on the River Nile, and ended up in rushes where the princess of Egypt bathed. And she found him. And God somehow wonderfully works his will through this child who is taken into the Egyptian court and raised there, protected by God. I mean, when you think, there were crocodiles in that river. That was quite an act of trust, putting that child in that basket. But God had a purpose. And God's purpose would not be contradicted, and God's purpose would not be undone. And his purpose was for his people to stand for him in the future, in their own land. And we are invited, as we read this story, again and again as we read it, to say, what's our judgment? Are we with Pharaoh, or are we with God? Are we willing to understand that sometimes when things are that come our way are not what we would choose at all, in any way, shape, or form, but are we willing to stop and say, God, what are you saying to us in this? I'm not sure I can accept it, but help me to understand it, and somehow, in your presence, show me what you can make of this. Sooner or later, most of us are forced to take a stand to decide whether we fear God or other people. And perhaps it will be at home, where family members are suspicious of our Christianity, or maybe it will be at work, where we're pressured to lie or cheat or steal, or it might be in our community, where our values contradict the spirit of the age. But when that time comes, what will we say? God is willing to give us the strength to say, I am a Christian and I have committed myself to Christ. And in a few moments, we're going to be able to say that in that eloquent way that Jesus has given us to express that, by taking bread, by drinking from the cup, a way of saying, I have committed myself to Christ and I will trust him. Let's sing together. We sing the song, Lord, I come to you.